From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Trump administration policy on separating children from their parents crossing the border illegally got perhaps more confusing today. Yesterday, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen tweeted out, "We do not have a policy of separating families at the border, period." And today she seemed to add to that, speaking before the National Sheriff's Association in New Orleans.
There has been much outcry, consternation, and frankly, misinformation that we at DHS are intentionally doing things that are unhumanitarian, that are cruel, immoral, and disgraceful. We aren't doing none of those things.
But she also cited statistics that showed an increase in people fraudulently using children to cross the border. And President Trump added to that in a tweet, tweeting out, "Children are being used by some of the worst criminals on earth as a means to enter our country, and Congress must change the laws around border security." Let's bring in NPR congressional correspondent Scott Detrow. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, it's confusing. I mean, Nielsen says yesterday we don't separate families, even though her own department, DHS, announced last week that nearly 2,000 kids have been separated from their parents.
Yeah.
Jeff Sessions cited the Bible defending the practice. Stephen Miller, the hardliner in the Trump White House, claims credit for it. Trump is trying to blame it on the Democrats, saying it's their law, but there is no law. Is this just a quagmire, or is there a plan here? Does President Trump think he can maybe leverage these images of crying children to move lawmakers to pass a bill he wants?
Well, in the last few days, we've had the Trump administration trying to blame this on Democrats, like you said, but that's just not true. We've been repeatedly reporting, and we've simply been quoting them previously. As you mentioned, several officials in the White House have not only said this was a decision by the administration to enforce this policy the way they have, but also that they viewed it in a strategic way. They viewed it as a deterrent to try to keep people from trying to cross the border. I mean, I'll just quote Secretary Nelson to NPR just last month talking about this policy. Operationally, what that means is we will have to separate your family. She said it right there in an interview with us.
And that policy is the zero tolerance policy. Just remind us quickly how we got here. It means criminalizing everyone that comes across illegally, not just detaining them, but criminalizing them. You have to prosecute them. And even, by the way, some of those seeking asylum. And it started in the Bush administration in 2004. They quickly realized if you criminalize adults, you have to take away the children. They can't be with criminals. How did the Bush administration and the Obama administration after them handle this?
Well, they were much more select in choosing to enforce or not enforce than the Trump administration has been. Like, as you mentioned, they've made a decision to enforce as many as possible people crossing the border illegally to charge them through the criminal process. Because, again, it is breaking the law to cross the border into the country illegally. Mm-hmm. What the administration is saying and what Secretary Nelson and others have said is that if you cross at a legal port of entry, if you ask for asylum there, you will be processed and not charged with a crime. But NPR has been reporting, as well as other outlets, that in many cases, officials at these legal ports of entry are turning people away, simply saying, there's no room for you here. You can't come through this entry point.
Look, First Lady Laura Bush has condemned the family separation policy in an op-ed. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have called for it to end. It doesn't look as if President Trump is going to back down on this. So how might it, again, there is no law right now about separating children from parents, but he keeps calling for something. How might Congress change this?
Well, there's going to be a vote in the House of Representatives this week on a broader immigration bill. This is the latest attempt by Republican leaders to try to connect all the different points of immigration policy we've been talking about into some sort of bill that has enough votes to pass a chamber of Congress. So far, everything's failed. One of the bills that's going to be voted on this week will broadly create some sort of permanent status for people in the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. It would also strengthen the border and make changes to legal immigration. There is talk now of adding in language allowing children to stay with their parents who are prosecuted for crossing the border illegally. It's not clear how that'll look in the final language, but from the reporting we've seen and some of the drafts out there of earlier versions, What it would basically do is allow children to stay with their parents, but still within ICE detention facilities.
And what the Bush and Obama administrations did was make exceptions for families or detain them together. But look, I said, you know, there's been an outcry, and there certainly has been, but there's a divide over this as well. This morning, while CNN was showing protests at some of the detention sites, Fox and Friends was talking to an officer after that terrible fatal car crash over the weekend in Texas, a car packed with undocumented immigrants, 12 of them, I think, five killed in that fatal car chase. And he was saying, the officer, we have to have a wall. So that's what a portion of the country was seeing, as opposed to seeing the protests. So what's your sense of where this goes?
I mean, we'll see what happens in the vote this week. I am curious to watch the vote total on this immigration package, because repeatedly there has been no path forward to a majority for any sort of bill that's been offered. The Senate voted on a series of immigration bills earlier this year, and the one measure that had all of those things I just laid mm-hmm. out that President Trump is calling for couldn't even get 40 votes in the Senate, nowhere near the votes it needed to pass with a majority. So it seems like that's the likely outcome for these votes in the House this week, unless something drastically changes. We do know that Democrats are really playing up this issue. They're very upset by mm-hmm. it. And it seems to be something that they think is a political positive for them to talk about. You've seen Democrats showing up at these detention facilities demanding to be let inside. But as you mentioned, there's a faction of Republican voters, base voters, who do want zero tolerance on the border.
Right. NPR congressional correspondent Scott Detrow. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, let's go to the border now with John Sepulveda, host of KQED's California Report. He's in El Paso, Texas. John, you were in the small town of Tornillo yesterday, where there is a tent housing over 100 undocumented boys. Very few officials and no reporters have been inside. What can you tell us about the tent?
It's a heavy-duty grade white tent in the middle of a desert. It's behind two chain-link fences, and there's a dirt easement that's on the top of it so that you can't actually see into it from the American side. It's not a city. There aren't multiples of tents, and there isn't a tent mess hall. It's just all one tent where these 16 and 17-year-olds are in.
How many are there right now?
I don't know. The last count I heard was 115. Then yesterday, I heard from two congressional sources that there were 98. And I have heard from immigrants' rights attorneys who actually be representing these kids that there will be up to 360 within the next week to 2 weeks. So it's really unclear how many teenagers are actually inside this camp.
And you also heard that it was going to expand to 4,000. Is that right?
Yeah, and we confirmed that. We confirmed that with several sources, including Republican Congressman Will Hurd, who was briefed on it. He's one of the few people who actually got to see inside the camp. He couldn't tell anyone what the camp actually looks like from the child's perspective, because he wasn't supposed to be there in the first place, and DHS let him in. Someone in DHS or HHS, that's unclear. And also from Democratic Congressman from El Paso, Beto O'Rourke, both confirmed that the plan by the federal government is to expand that site from the hundreds that are there now to 4,000. That's almost triple the size of the town that it's in. Tornillo right now has a population of about 1,200. At its highest, it's a migrant town, so it kind of peaks and declines. It gets to 1,600. And you can see that they are clearly looking to expand, because there is the kind of equipment needed to be able to build new encampments. How many that will hold, I don't know. It's a small site, Jeremy. Again, I can't tell you the acreage, but it's, you know, maybe the size of a farm field. It's not your standard farm field you'd see on the side of the road. It's not that sprawling of a complex. That's a lot of children in a very small area.
Are they getting legal representation at this point?
So that is one of the big issues. Right now, the kids are, and in fact, because many of the kids came from other detention centers, they probably have seen a lawyer and transferred lawyers. Again, we don't know because federal officials aren't talking. The question is going forward. This is Tornillo, Texas. This is a very small town that's outside of El Paso, and El Paso doesn't have a lot of lawyers to begin with anyways. There's not investigators. So there is a concern that there's not going to be enough lawyers. Then on top of it, there's a woman named Melissa Lopez, who actually is an attorney for these kids, Her firm's going to represent up to 360 of them. And because these children are being classified as unaccompanied minors, that creates a whole nother set of legal headaches. Here she is.
There are rules about how long somebody can be detained after they've already been ordered deported. And so that's still somewhat up in the air. But I do think that you'll see people in detention longer because first the parents are going through the criminal process. And so they're in detention throughout that criminal process. And then they go into the immigration detention process. And for the kids, if their parents are in detention and there's nobody else that they can be released to, then the kids are going to be in detention longer too.
And so, Jeremy, you just heard her say process, process, process. So even if you don't quite understand the legalese behind that, you know that when you hear process, it is going to be a process, and the courts here are already backlogged.
It's John Sepulveda, who hosts KQED's California Report, joining us from El Paso, Texas. John, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
You may know that at least 37 states have created programs to donate unused medications. We'll link you at herenow.org so you can see what might work for you. But in Greece, they have an app for that. Greece is still struggling to recover from that financial crisis of 2010. 2 million people, about 20% of the population, live below the poverty line. Thousands don't have access to medical care or prescriptions. But a nonprofit organization called GiveMed is now helping people donate their leftover medications to organizations in need of them. It's through an app that's facilitated over $200,000 worth of drug donations since it was developed in 2016. By former Google intern Thanasis Ratimos, who joins us by Skype from Athens. Thanasis, so we understand you have the database of need. If someone has leftover meds they'd like to donate, they can scan the barcode. Tell us more. How does it work?
It's something like this. When you scan the barcode, we can understand the name of the medicine, the expiration date, and other important information about this medicine. The user has to select if the medicine is open or closed, because in some cases you cannot donate open medicines. And we have collected all the medicine needs that social pharmacies and other organizations which support people in need have. And we make the matching between the leftover medicines that users register with the medicine needs of organizations who support the social vulnerable groups.
You've hit on the concern that a lot of people would have about a program like this. Sometimes you can't donate an open medication. Here in the United States, many of the collection centers, you can't ever donate something, you know, a bottle that's been opened, even a pill bottle that's been opened. How do you know when these medications go from the donor to the organization, how do you know that they haven't been tampered with?
So we give medicines only to organizations, meaning that these organizations have a pharmacist who is responsible to check the medicine. So he's responsible to decide if this medicine is in a good condition in order to donate it to somebody in need. And if the pharmacist decides that this medicine is not appropriate for somebody, he is responsible to destroy it. So we are not responsible to check the medicine, to store it. We are just the facilitator of the process of medicine donations.
Yeah. Well, in fact, right after you launched GiveMed, the Greek Association of Pharmacists published a letter calling the platform a serious risk to public health because of concerns about the safety of the pill exchange. But as you've just explained, every organization has to have an in-house pharmacist that will check out the medications.
The problem is that they didn't understand what we do. They thought that we give medicines directly to individuals and that we store medicine. But this is this is not true.
Yeah.
The truth is that social pharmacies, which are like the regular pharmacies, but they accept medicine donations from individuals and they give them for free to people in need, they have an in-house pharmacist who is responsible for all this process. These social pharmacies are funded by the government.
What prompted you to do this?
A couple of years ago, when my grandfather passed away, my family and I ended up with many boxes of medicines that we didn't need. And it was really difficult to find a way to give them to other people who really need them. Mm. So I came up with this idea. I was really lucky because I found other people who believed in this vision, and we worked together in order to develop GiveMed.
We understand you're funded by people, private companies, social foundations. It's not just getting medication to people who need it. It's also getting out of the environment. We know that when medications are flushed down the toilet, they affect the water systems. We suddenly have medications exactly. involved with our drinking water. It seems like an all-around good idea. But there are countries like Britain, for instance, does not allow this at all, any kind of donations of medication. Do you hope that not only do countries start to do it, but that they do it in this way with an app? Where would you like to see this going?
Okay, so I believe that people are very positive to this kind of initiatives when they have an easy way to support people in need. They are 100% positive to do it. The point is to give them a really easy and a fast way to do it. I think that the biggest problem is that we have to change the attitude. Most people don't even think that they can do something with their leftover medicines. And we are working to raise awareness about the problem and motivate them in order to donate their leftover medicines.
Well, you'd actually like to see the government take over your app.
Actually, I think that what we do is something that the government had to do. Unfortunately, because of the financial crisis, many people do not have access to the medicines they need, and the government cannot support them. So non-profit organizations like GiveMed should support all these people. But I hope that in a couple of years, the government could support these people, and the society will not need these kind of organizations.
That's Thanasis Ratimos, co-founder of the nonprofit organization GiveMed, with an app that helps people find places to donate their unused medication. Thanasis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
President Trump turned 72 last week, but he came onto the national scene when he was in his 20s. He took over the family business in 1971, becoming president of what became the Trump Organization. And our next guest says when you listen to Trump's comments now on a range of issues, it's clear his worldview was formed in the 1970s. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Jeremy.
And you say trade is a good example. The president has been speaking out against China, but also Japan.
That's right. You go back and you look at the U.S. trade balance. You know, in the 1950s, we were the world's factory. In the 1960s, the U.S. was still running a trade surplus. It was really only in the 1970s that our trade deficit opened up. That means that we bought more from other countries than countries bought from us. And in the last 40 years or so, it's just bloomed. And Trump, more than other presidents, is fixated on this trade deficit. He thinks it is a sign of American weakness. The way that people talked about the opening of the trade deficit being a sign of American weakness in the 1970s, when we were afraid of other countries sort of stealing our lead. In particular, Japan was coming onto the world stage in the 1970s. And so it's funny there, again, you know, Japan, which has been such a close ally to presidents like Obama, is getting a little bit of a hard time with Trump. He rebuffs them on TPP. He doesn't take their advice on North Korea. And I think that Trump's perspective, both on the trade balance and on Japan, is rooted in this sort of 1970s approach to economics and foreign policy.
Well, and when it comes to economics, he's also been focused a lot on industries in this country, including coal and steel, which kind of hit their peak in the 1970s.
They sure did. I mean, the economy of today and the economy of the future is what I've called about nerds and nurses. It's computer science and it's healthcare. That's the future of the U.S. economy. The past of the U.S. economy is steel, coal, and manufacturing. Trump praises steel workers. He speaks wistfully of coal mining, and he tweets boastfully of any new manufacturing factories. But the number of American coal miners has collapsed in the last few decades. Right. The solar industry alone now employs two times as many people as coal. The steel industry has shrunk dependably year after year, decade after decade, since the late 1970s. So once again, in national, in domestic economic policy, we see that he is essentially porting a worldview that was frozen in carbonite in the 1970s.
Well, and we have to talk about crime, too, because that's something he talks a lot about. And that goes back to the 1970s as well, which, by the way, was actually a much more violent time.
A much more violent time. Oh, basically every single measure of crime, burglaries, murders, vehicular theft, all of it was rising in the 1970s and even a little bit into the 1980s, the famous The Bronx is Burning announcement from the late 1970s in New York. But crime in the U.S. has been falling for a long time. And yet Trump still talks about waves of crime. American carnage was the phrase in his first inauguration. This problem of the inner cities. I mean, go into, quote, inner cities. In the downtown area of most American metros is not only a nice place to live, it's becoming too expensive for a lot of people. So again, I think the way he talks about sort of America's urban demography and crime statistics is, again, basically a reflection of a 1970s worldview.
So what does this tell you about him, Derek, that he has all of these views that you say were shaped from the 1970s?
Yeah, I think this is a little bit of a skeleton key, both into his psychology and that of his supporters. You know, Trump, you know, walked onto the national stage saying, make America great again, an explicitly nostalgic message. But he's selling nostalgia to a demographic that is itself nostalgic. They think America's best times are behind it. I'm talking about working class, white, particular men, especially those that are older, less educated. This was the marrow of the U.S. economy in the 1950s through 1970s. Right. And now, in many ways, they see that their lot is declining, and so they've thrown it behind a champion of their nostalgic cause.
I was looking, and I saw that the first time Trump appeared in the New York Times was actually in 1973. That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Thousands of years ago, a horse was bred with a donkey and the mule was born. Sturdy, reliable hybrids that were soon used all over the world. And while cars and trucks have mostly replaced them now, there's a spot where mules still reign supreme. Stina Sieg from member station KJZZ reports.
If you've ever hiked the Grand Canyon, you know this is when you need to step aside. A young man in chaps and a cowboy hat rides a mule up the South Kaibab Trail with a lumbering line of mules behind, all carrying full bags. Every day, the mules carry supplies and souvenirs down to the canyon floor and haul trash back up to the south rim. But that's not their only cargo. These mule-riding tourists are returning from a one-night trip to Phantom Ranch, the bunkhouse at the bottom of the canyon. John Barry's here to greet him.
How was it?
It was wonderful.
Good.
Yahoo!
Now there's a bunch of happy people.
Barry, who manages the mules for the company Zanterra, gives a lot of credit to the wranglers who guide these trips. But he knows who truly makes these rides possible.
I kind of think of a mule as a four-wheel drive pickup truck, where a horse would be more like a Cadillac.
Mules are sure-footed and tough, Barry says. And they don't scare easily. They've carried an estimated million people in and out of the canyon since the late 1800s. The rides are daily, stopped pretty much only by dangerous weather and government shutdowns. Barry was here when the government stopped running for 2 weeks in 2013.
And these mules were so bored. I truly believe that they love to work.
And lots of people in the canyon love to work with them. Like Josiah Dreyer, a packer. He grew up around horses and donkeys as well, but describes himself this way.
I'm a mule guy.
As he straps down bags onto his mules, Dreyer says he likes how intelligent the animals are. They're calm out on the trail, and Dreyer says they don't forget.
If you do something to a mule, that mule will get you back 7 years later, and you will know why it did that.
Maintenance man Joseph Kendall can also vouch for their smarts. He's befriended a giant mule named Kaibab Bob, who's convalescing right now at the bottom of the canyon.
Make sure you eat all that, all right?
Kaibab Bob injured himself while packing supplies into the canyon. But that's extremely rare. John Barry says that mules are much better at tackling these trails than people. As he tells a fresh crop of riders every morning,
"We have never lost one of you due to the mule."
Still, he is frank in his safety talk, held right before they head down the south rim.
"Okay, this is no pony ride at the county fair. This is a tough, hard ride."
By the end, a little girl from Boston is in tears.
"She's really scared."
"Yeah, yeah, yeah, we'll talk, yeah. All right, go use the bathroom."
But within minutes, the girl has summoned her courage. As Barry lifts her onto the mule, her eyes are still wet, but she tries to smile.
"Now you take good care of John S. for me, okay? He's a good mule."
Shortly after the group disappears below the rim, Barry radios one of the wranglers, who's riding just in front of her.
"How's she doing, Cindy?"
"She's good. We're talking about cats."
"Well, good."
For Here and Now, I'm Stina Seek, reporting from the Grand Canyon.
Couple headlines from higher education. Harvard University is being sued by the group Students for Fair Admissions, which says Harvard discriminates against Asian American applicants. Harvard says the group is using what it called gerrymandered statistics. Also, as you may have heard on our show last Friday, the University of Chicago will no longer require SAT or ACT scores. It's the first of the top 10 research universities to do so. But enough about these top-tier schools. One college counselor says high school students who put all their efforts into those name-brand schools may not be making wise decisions. Lisa Maselli is director of college counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School in Urbana, my alma mater. Lisa, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeremy. Great to be with you.
And you call these top-tier schools bumper sticker schools. You say that this is not a good idea to just throw your effort into those. Why?
Yeah, I don't want high-achieving and hardworking and successful kids to be intimidated to go for those schools. But Jeremy, I spend so much time talking with students with these awesome GPAs, great test scores, and they truly believe that that's the only tier of schools who are going to give them challenge, that are going to give them peers that they can connect with. And that's so not true.
And why do you say that's not true? What other schools will be able to give them the level of challenge that they clearly are looking for?
Right. Well, ironically, the schools that I think are often overlooked are schools that could be, for instance, state schools with honors programs that have specific incentives for kids that are high achieving and maybe might be above their profile of who they've admitted in the past to come and be a part of a selective group with extra perks and extra independent studies and relationships with professors. There are also so many liberal arts colleges that are geared towards kids who want to learn, have a desire to go deep into a subject area, that often because they don't fall into that Ivy League tier, they often get overlooked as well. There's over 3,500 colleges out there. And I think that we tend to see kids and families, and sometimes even the press, obsess over just a certain group of schools, and there's more than 30 colleges out there.
How many schools should somebody apply to?
Yeah, I like to tell families and students, when you build that list, and it has to be balanced, stay 10 and under. When you start getting into double digits, your application is weak. Often kids don't know why they're applying. They're just throwing darts, hoping that they hit something. And the reality is, when they have applications that go to more than 10 schools, you often say, so why are you applying? Why is the psychology program different at this school than the other school? And they look at you and they don't know the answer. They usually apply to lots of schools. And I'm talking, I've seen kids apply to 17, 23 schools. And it's all because of the U.S. News rankings reports.
Hmm. So if you are going to apply for 10 schools or fewer than 10 schools, what should the mix be?
Sure. Well, we like kids to have at least one or two what I like to call foundation schools, or they'll often find on websites calling them likely schools. And these are schools that when they look at the profile of who has been admitted at those colleges over the years, they're well above that middle 50th percentile. But it's important that students, when they build those foundation schools, they love them. So many times, Jeremy, they look at their likely schools as their backup or their schools that are going to be the consolation prize, mm-hmm, if, God forbid, the reach schools don't admit them. So I think in a 10-tier group of colleges that you're building, you want to have two foundation or likely schools, two schools that are in your target range. And then if you do want to reach for those schools, I wouldn't do more than two or three of those also.
Is the blame here on the student, do you think, or on the parents, on the college counselors in some cases that try to encourage these students to reach for these top tier schools?
Sure. Well, I think we don't want to fall into this hole of undermatching kids. I do think we also have students around the country who are intimidated by the process of college admissions, maybe don't have anyone mentoring them or helping them. So oftentimes they will undermatch where they go. So we don't want students to be afraid to reach. That's where that term came from. You reach for those schools, but there's no guarantee. But I think when it comes to helping them build a balanced list of schools, I think we're all guilty. I think we have to be the counselors, the parents, and the college admissions professionals who model what it means to build a healthy list of schools that are balanced and don't just fall into an uber reach tier to possibly set them up for disappointment, denials, wait lists. And that's what I think I'm seeing happening, especially with high achieving kids that look at their outcomes for college over what this healthy process should be.
When you talk about the admissions officers, you write that they should stop traveling to high schools and hosting evening info sessions with only those schools that they consider to be peer institutions. What do you mean by that?
Right. An example of this is a program that goes around the country, and it's Duke, Georgetown, Harvard, Penn, and Stanford. And they travel and they book hotels. They get a standing room only crowd. And I sit in the audience as a counselor and think, how is this serving our students to understand how to build a balanced list? So I'm sitting there often thinking, why isn't the University of Pennsylvania traveling with Bucknell and Penn State and Villanova and Haverford and Bryn Mawr? Why aren't they thinking about what the purpose of that meeting is and to maybe use that as a vehicle to expose families to a certain region of the country, but have them understand how you look at colleges with their admissions rates to think about what are my likely, my target, and my reach schools. I really wish colleges would think about their travels and frame it in a healthy way for families.
What if you are a student, let's say, in Texas, and you decide that you only want to apply to the University of Texas because it's affordable, it's a very good school, it's right there, close to your family? Is that wrong to just pick one school and say, I'm just going to try to get in here?
Sure. I'm glad you brought that up, because building a college list, which has become such a huge conversation, like you mentioned, with kids maybe over-applying, and now you're asking about, is it okay or is it safe to do one? The answer is, based on the student profile and how their high school counselor is assisting them, absolutely. We have students, for instance, at my high school who come in and say, my dream is the University of Illinois. This is my GPA. This is my test score. This is the major I'm thinking. With that knowledge, it's pretty easy to work with admissions officers and understand, is this student doing the right thing by potentially doing one school? So I don't want your listeners to think this is all about making sure that they visit colleges and build a list of 10 or under. I have worked with students, absolutely, who have come in and said, I know where I want to go. Do you think that this is in my range? And with data that we keep to show what the trends of admissions have looked like over the years, we can help them decide if one school is a risk or if one school will be safe for them.
Do you find yourself as a college counselor having to counsel people about how to deal with the amount of debt that they might end up with after going to school?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what has happened, because this concept of what is the best college, what does the prestige and the name of the college mean? What does success after the undergrad look like? There are many families that are willing to take incredible financial strain on their family and on even potential retirement so that they can invest in a school that might give what they think is going to be the best outcome for the future later. And we have to really help families and kids think about, what are you investing in? What are you going to, and what do you want to get out of your 4 years of undergrad experience? And to caution them about, loans aren't bad. If they get a need-based loan and they're building a credit history and they're paying things off, they can actually build a good credit record to get their first loan for a car or a condo. But when I see kids that come in and say, I got into this college and I want to take out $50,000 my freshman year, and you ask them why, and it all has to do with bragging rights and the name of the school, that's where we have to get down to soul searching and really find out what is the motivation here regarding why they want to go to that college.
One more thing, for people who have already picked their school, some students are getting one last summer off before they start college. What should they be doing with that time?
Oh, great. Okay, so us college freshmen that's going to be matriculating soon, they've worked hard. Obviously, we want them to make sure that they've worked with their high school counselor and had their final transcript sent so that the college doesn't revoke their admission because they have to see that they actually graduated. We want them to make sure that they release their official test scores. And if they've taken any college courses or they've done community college work, they have to release those records to the college they're matriculating to. But they've worked hard. Now is the time, again, for them to think about family and friends, balance, relaxation. But if they do have passions that they've been working on and in basically investing in and doing impact, if they want to keep those things continued so that they can continue those in the college that they go to, that's great. But so many times, Jeremy, we're just begging some students before they head off to college to get rest, reconnect with people, show gratitude to those who have helped you and who have gotten to you where you are today, and leave heading off to college ready and energized.
That's Lisa Maselli, Director of College Counseling at the University of Illinois Laboratory High School, my high school. Lisa, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
What is going on in Syria? The conflict there began 7 years ago with a peaceful protest against President Bashar Assad. He responded with that violent crackdown that triggered a civil war. It's now a proxy war over a country that's largely in rubble. U.S. airstrikes have targeted the Assad regime. Russia is backing Assad. Israel is skirmishing with Iranian forces, which also back the regime. ISIS entered the vacuum created by the war to fight Assad. But the Kurds in the country are fighting ISIS. Turkey is fighting the Kurds. Syrian state media today reports that an airstrike hit pro-government forces in the east, and in a separate incident, more than two dozen troops from Iraq, also fighting for the Syrian government, died in another battle. The BBC's Martin Patience is following all of this from Beirut. Martin, it just feels like Syria is a petri dish of violence. Start with this airstrike. Do we know who was behind that?
Well, again, it's a murky incident in the east of the country. According to Syrian state media, they say that the US-led mission carried out airstrikes in a Syrian army position close to a town of Al-Hiri. Now, that's close to the border with Iraq, according to Syrian state media. Those strikes killed several people, and one report suggests up to 40 fighters were perhaps killed in this incident. Another report suggested a drone may have been used, so perhaps it wasn't airplanes. But the US military has come out very strongly to say that their aircraft, or indeed any of their forces, were not operating in that area, and they are denying anything to do with it. So a lot of questions and not many answers at the moment.
Which defines Syria. What do we know about the... I mean, is it ongoing? Is there fighting every day? Or are there battles every day? How does the violence and the war now compare to a year ago? What's the... Give us context here.
There's no straightforward battles. We did, in recent months, however, see heavy bombardment of an area close to the Syrian capital, Damascus. That was called Eastern Ghouta. And the Syrian government, backed up by Russia and Iran, they retook that from the rebels. There are pockets of resistance. Some of them are rebels, some of them are Islamic State across the country. But it really isn't straightforward. This is a conflict where you have multiple players fighting multiple battles. It's like a massive chessboard. I think the danger always is in Syria is that perhaps a small incident could trigger something far bigger.
Well, in 2015, when the Russian military, you know, came into the conflict to support Assad, it was said to turn the tide in his favor. Is that still the status quo, the sense that he is probably not leaving? Or is this, you know, a completely failed state? What's your sense?
Well, Russia is supporting the Syrian government, and its air power has been key to the Syrian government's success of retaking cities and towns under rebel control in the last couple of years. And it continues to support the Syrian government along with Iran. There are large parts of the country which have been completely destroyed, including some of the main cities, parts of Aleppo, for example. But generally speaking, the feeling is that the Syrian government is in control. President Assad is perhaps at his most secure ever since this uprising began almost 7 years ago. But he oversees a country that has been ruined. He faces a huge amount of reconstruction. It's not clear how that's going to be paid for. And the problem is with Syria is that, as you were mentioning, it is a proxy battle. And the fear is that potentially something that happens in Syria could potentially draw in the whole region. For example, what we've increasingly seen in recent months is a proxy, an open proxy battle between Iran and Israel. Mm-hmm. Iran is supporting the Syrian government. Israel is frequently been carrying out airstrikes on Iranian installations and bases inside that country.
Yeah. Well, and the U.S. also has troops on the ground in Syria to fight ISIS. They are in harm's way. What's the sense of endgame?
It's very difficult to know what the endgame in Syria will be. This is a conflict that has evolved over time. When you go back to the start of the conflict, there was a feeling that President Bashar al-Assad would be overthrown. Nobody is talking about that at the moment. I think what we're seeing is a new phase of the conflict. So what's happening in Syria is increasingly being felt across the region. So, for example, you have the Israelis and the Saudis and the Americans. They're very worried about Iran's influence in Syria. They're trying to pare that back. So we are seeing an increasing number of airstrikes against Iranian assets in the country. And the big fear potentially is that the dynamics that are at play in Syria could potentially trigger a regional conflict. We saw that back in April when we saw American airstrikes. What everybody was talking about was potentially some kind of standoff between the Americans and the Russians who are backing the Syrian government. That came to naught, but that danger, that calculation hasn't gone away.
No, and you've repeated it several times. Obviously, that's on the mind of many. The BBC's Martin Patience in Beirut with an update on Syria, a grim one. Martin, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.